Welcome to The Check-In, a podcast by the Telos Group on the Telos channel. The Check-In is a semi-regular conversation where we deep dive into the headlines from Israel, Palestine, and across the world, where we wade into the complexity of seemingly intractable conflict to discover the power of peacemaking to heal us, our community, and our world. This is your host, David Cadabot, checking in from Washington, D.C. today, and we are responding to current news coming out this morning from the UN Security Council. So our apologies for the audio quality on this episode, but we have important news to discuss. I'm here with a small team today. All right, Greg, where are you checking in from?
New York City.
Sarah, where are you checking in from?
Checking in from Washington, D.C.
Great. Folks, we are nearly 6 months into this crisis in Israel-Palestine. More than 31,000 Palestinians in Gaza have been killed, majority of them women and children, tens of thousands wounded with life-altering injuries, and limited to no access to medical care, stories of children having surgeries without anesthetic. Meanwhile, around 130 Israelis and others remain hostages in Gaza, and most of Gaza is on the edge of famine, if it hasn't already yet plunged in. People are going critically hungry. Now, the ICJ has offered a preliminary ruling on the situation, saying this is plausibly a case of genocide. And if you haven't heard our episodes on that ruling, please go back to the two most recent episodes in which we discuss this ruling. Today, more than 1.5 million Palestinians have been pushed to the south of Gaza and Rafah, where they were told they could seek refuge, but have faced airstrikes, inhumane living conditions, a lack of access to food, water, housing, or sanitation, and prepare for a promised Israeli ground invasion, which would have catastrophic consequences for the civilian population gathered there. All of this is the context that puts today's UN Security Council resolution into clear view. This morning, the UN Security Council passed a resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. And the U.S., contrary to past situations, has abstained. What does this mean for the region? What does this mean for this crisis? And how do we move forward? That's a conversation for today. So let's get started first by discussing some of the background to know why this is so important. Greg, can you catch us up to speed for those who may not be aware of, around international institutions? What is the UN Security Council and how does it work?
The UN Security Council is the highest body within the United Nations. There are 15 members. Five members are permanent members, including the United States, Great Britain, Russia, China. And the Security Council has the capacity to actually pass binding international law. The five permanent members have a veto on the Security Council. So what's significant today is the Security Council actually passed a vote calling for ceasefire. There have been at least three different resolutions put forward for ceasefire, but the U.S., as a permanent member, vetoed each and every one of those resolutions calling for ceasefire. So what does this mean? I think this means a lot more politically than it does legally. It just means that there's a shift in the dynamics about how the world is viewing this conflict, and specifically how the United States is viewing what the International Court of Justice has already deemed as a plausible case of genocide.
So to catch us up again, there have been three resolutions that have been proposed in the UN Security Council. The U.S. has vetoed them three times. And as we know, the U.S. has a history also of using its veto power, which is an immense power in this space, to shield Israeli policies at this level of the United Nations. There's a General Assembly outside, but as you said, the UN Security Council has the authority to pass binding resolutions. In this case, what does that mean for it to be a legally binding resolution for a ceasefire? What difference is it going to make on the ground as this crisis continues to unfold?
David, that's an interesting question. And part of the answer to that is really unsatisfactory. But the other part of the answer, in my view, is really relevant to anyone who's listening right now. So international law can sound like this big sort of like, you know, thing that the Oracle in Delphi pronounces. It feels very abstract. It feels very disconnected from our daily lives. People invoke it a lot, particularly in respect to the Middle East. But what is international law? That's a really big question. And right now it's being frayed because we're in a moment of global crisis right now. So we can dive back, you know, down into that academic question. But what international law represents in this moment is it represents political will, political sort of focus. And so, you know, aside from the legally binding thing, there isn't like a sheriff. There isn't, you know, if you get this resolution today calling for an immediate ceasefire for the remainder of Ramadan, leading hopefully to a permanent ceasefire, like it's technically legally binding, but nobody's going to enforce that. There is no actual real enforcement mechanism, at least on the short term. And so what's significant about this, though, is that the politics have shifted. It's taken almost 6 months and almost 40,000 people dead, the majority of them women and children, and millions experiencing enduring horrors that most human beings throughout the history of humanity could not even imagine, alongside more than 100 Israelis still alive and still being held captive in Gaza. But the point is that what's happened right now is the U.S. abstained, 14 other members of the Security Council voted yes. The U.S. has decided not to continue to block calls for a ceasefire. And what's interesting about that is likely due to the domestic political calculus here. What President Biden is seeing on the streets, he's seeing in city council rooms around the country, he's seeing many people speak up in unusual ways and saying, hey, this has got to stop. Like, you know, violence is how we got here. It's not how we get out. This isn't like ending Hamas. This isn't achieving any of these goals that Israel states. Instead, this is drawing us down into a moral, political, humanitarian quagmire that's going to affect the world for generations to come. And so there's a real shift here. That shift is political. And the political shift happened because people like you listening, as demoralized as we may all be right now, have been speaking up. So now is the time to speak up even more.
So I think that your point around there's no sheriff for the international community is an important one. From what I'm seeing, this is a moment to recognize we're moving in the direction of accountability. We're moving in the direction of all of this ending. However, this isn't, you know, the panacea of this conflict or of this crisis, right? We're still waiting to see how Israel will respond. Do you imagine that this will change Israel's relationship to these international institutions? And if so, what difference will that make? I know there's been a lot of critique of the United Nations, of other international bodies in the past couple of months from within the Israeli government and Israeli society. How do you expect this to affect that relationship?
Well, Netanyahu responded very quickly, and he denounced the U.S.'s abstention, and he canceled a delegation of Israeli leaders headed for Washington, D.C. to meet and to discuss plans for Israel's invasion of Rafah in the southern Gaza Strip, where more than 1 million Gazans are seeking refuge right now. The short answer to that is no, nothing. Like, Netanyahu's doubling down. The longer answer says it remains to be seen. So the reality is, like, a lot of people like to scapegoat Netanyahu or Hamas or Abbas or all of these various different actors. All of the leadership you see on the ground in Israel-Palestine today, whether they are, you know, terrorist organizations or they are actual political leaders who were elected, a lot of this is enabled by the international community's involvement, how we spend our money, how and whether or not we hold people accountable and governments accountable. You know, we've been sending Israel billions of dollars every year for decades, well over $100 billion over the last 40 years. We fast-tracked weapons to them while Congress has been stalled on this Ukraine and Israel aid because of domestic politics. The Biden administration just fast-tracked hundreds of millions of dollars of weapons to Israel. We give the Palestinian Authority, headquartered in the West Bank with Abbas, hundreds of millions of dollars a year. We are real players on the ground. That's the thing that Americans miss here, is that, like, you know, it's not a question of whether we're involved. We're involved up to our teeth. We're spending billions of dollars every year of taxpayer money. We are changing the course of how the international community engages this, like, you know, our veto power in the United States Security Council, United Nations Security Council, rather. And, you know, DCAT, you mentioned that we vetoed three prior ceasefire resolutions, but I think you might be surprised to know that other than procedural issues in the Security Council, the U.S. has almost uniformly used its veto power many dozens of times over decades on Israel's behalf. So we have like really been directing the way the international community engages this. And part of the result of this are these leaders on the ground, some of whom, like Netanyahu, who've never faced any kind of accountability, either from the international community or his own people. And so when you ask me this question, DCAT, it feels like there's a lot of complexity there. But like, hey, if you allow someone to run around, like, you know, with a free leash to do whatever, and they don't face any accountability, it doesn't mean, you know, you're to blame for their bad actions, but there should be no surprise. And this is what we've seen consistently in Israel-Palestine. So to put a couple finer points on that, Netanyahu, for example, he's going to face accountability from his own people and from his own government. He's facing criminal charges if he's no longer prime minister. And he has less than a 30% approval rating. Everyone blames him for what happened on October 7th, for being asleep at the wheel or even helping to build up Hamas beforehand. He's been shielded from accountability this whole time by Biden's, you know, explicit embrace of him post October 7th. Hamas, they stepped into this vacuum, you know, in a context in which the international community hasn't won an election since 2005, and they've supported Abbas in the West Bank, who has done very little for his people other than to build up a Palestinian Authority and a disconnected elite ruling class that takes a lot of international aid while Palestinians suffer under what human rights organizations, including Israeli human rights organizations, call apartheid. Like, the point is, I'm not saying that we need to like tell these leaders what to do and who to be, but if we're spending billions of dollars and we've done this for decades and nobody is ever held accountable for human rights violations, a lot of what we're seeing on the ground is predictable from Hamas's October 7th attacks, which were predicted for decades. Remember that? Netanyahu's failed leadership and Abbas's failed leadership. All of this is predictable. So we don't know where it goes from here, but like, at least if we're talking about accountability and human rights and recognizing that violence is how we got here, not how we get out, at least the conversation might be shifting to a better place. Is that going to be soon enough to save lives and livelihoods in Gaza at this scale of atrocity the world has rarely seen? Sadly, no, but hopefully this can prevent this from becoming a much wider regional conflict or worse.
What's interesting is to see the U.S. say that this is not a change of policy or, you know, change in approach to abstain rather than veto, but it's clearly being seen as such by the Israeli government. But what you're saying around this changes the international community's understanding or the protection of international norms is really important. And Sarah, I don't know if you want to jump in on that point.
Yeah, this is something I've been thinking about, especially about the broader implications of this decision, not just for Israelis and Palestinians, but for anyone caught in a context globally where the UN Security Council would need to intervene or where international law has been eroded and needs to be respected. As we've talked about today and before, one of the challenges with the Security Council or the UN in general is that they don't really have those teeth to implement things that they might be legally binding, but they can't force countries to adopt them. And I think it's going to be really interesting, and I'm not super optimistic, but I am hopeful, right? Always have to hope for the best and not fall into that despair. It's going to be interesting to see how Israel does respond. Because when these international norms get eroded anywhere, they get eroded everywhere. And that's really important for all of us to be aware of and pay attention to, because we care about contexts around the globe beyond just Israel-Palestine. And if this is a time where Israel decides they're not going to respect what is an internationally legally binding agreement put forth by the UN, that really sends a signal not just to other, you know, allies, but also to other restrictive regimes, or I was going to say dictators, maybe that's not quite the right word, but repressive states, authoritarian states, that they also don't need to respect international law. And so that I think is really important to keep in mind as we look at what happens over the next days and weeks too, is that this really is kind of a moment of the UN has put out this huge symbolic statement. Can it become more than symbolic, or will this be an instance where, you know, the US has finally abstained, we've finally moved in a direction where ceasefire is what we need for the future of possibility for peace and justice in Israel-Palestine, Or will this be kind of a crucial moment where international norms are eroded further because Israel doesn't respect them and it becomes even more of a toothless kind of empty, unserious institution, which for me is a possibility that's really scary, right? For context beyond Israel-Palestine. So what Israel does has implications beyond just this current moment in the Holy Land.
Yeah, I want to pick up on that because I think it's more than what Israel does right here. And I think, you know, it's not just a possibility, but sadly a probability that the international community does not rise to this moment. But I want to make two related points, which I think are really, really critical if you're listening to this podcast to internalize. So first is there's a much bigger context here than October 7th and Israel-Palestine, on Israel-Palestine, but globally. And so you'll remember with the invasion of the Ukraine, President Biden was talking about, you know, maintaining and protecting the rules-based international order, human rights that were so, so, you know, difficultly won and fought for post-World War II. Now, there's a really interesting story there that, like, we can share in another deep dive podcast at some point. But the point now is, since October 7th, the U.S., which has sometimes been seen at least trying to move the world towards some semblance of universal norms and whatnot, is, like, been exposed in the eyes of many as the absolute hypocrite. Like, you wanted to do one thing for Ukraine, but look at what you're doing all over the world, and particularly in Israel-Palestine. Palestinian lives don't matter. It's great that we're fighting anti-Semitism and even Islamophobia, but, like, how can you even say that you're really fighting with these things when you're giving a green light to what's happening on Gaza now and what's been happening in Palestine for decades, right? So at least this perception around the world right now is that the U.S. project of trying to be the champion of universal norms and human rights norms has been exposed to be totally fraudulent at its core. And that's happening while we have other parties who don't even share the aspiration to human rights norms, such as Russia and China, gaining global prominence right now. So this whole idea of the rules-based international order, President Biden was correct in saying that it was a threat at some time, but it's never been more threatened right now. And, you know, I personally believe that, like, human rights actually do matter. And this is important. And that the only way out of this is to recognize, of course, what happened on October 7th was wrong because it targeted civilians. And there's never any justification for targeting civilians. But what happened after October 7th and what's happening after October 7th is wrong, too. And many things that have happened before then are wrong. And if we're going to create a global community in which we can live in true safety and which people can flourish, we have to do our best to make sure that everyone's human rights are protected. And there are ways to do that, but we have to be intentional about it. So the stakes are really high. The second point I wanted to make, though, is that a lot of this shift comes back to politics. It's not just like what Israel does or doesn't do. Israel's been given a free rein for many years to build as many settlements as it wants, to, you know, conduct this war in Gaza with U.S. funding and munitions and coordination even. Like, you know, you're watching those airlifts, those bizarre airlifts, you know, rather than letting the trucks get into Gaza. Like, of course, those airlifts are coordinated with the Israeli military. This isn't like Biden going in against Netanyahu. This is a dance that everybody's dancing for their various reasons. But the thing to remember right here is that, you know, we can talk about politics as a dirty word, but the Biden administration should be put on notice right now that most Americans, liberal and conservative, as they learn these stories, are not okay with the direction and of this war, with the direction that we as a country are heading, with the role of America in the broader world. And as we let them know that, as we speak up with our voices, whether or not we intend to vote in certain ways, with our money, who we donate to, what conversations we have, if we're members of faith community, with our pastors who've been completely silent, we have real power right now. And that's particularly true for the Christians on this call. It's particularly true during Easter right now, when the world's oldest Christian community, Palestinian Christians, is literally dying before our eyes. A higher proportion of Christians have died in Gaza than any other population there right now. And they were already on the brink of extinction throughout Israel, Jerusalem, West Bank, and Gaza before October 7th. Your voice has incredible power right now. It may not feel that way. But remember, when you feel helpless and voiceless, we're here in the States. We're here in the West. We're not on the ground in Gaza. And remember, too, that the only reason why the U.S. abstained, President Biden abstained, and why Chuck Schumer got on the congressional floor, the highest ranking elected Jewish official in U.S. history, got on the floor and denounced Netanyahu, was because so many Americans of different stripes are speaking up. And so all of us have a voice right now. That's how we got here. It's great they're finally listening, but ceasefire is just the very, 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 very beginning. It's the first step, not the last step. So it's our job to keep speaking up.
There's a lot more work to do, Greg, as you're saying, and it's really important that people see that, that this is just the beginning and that our futures are intertwined. That until we move forward, not only past a ceasefire and release of all captives and return of hostages, that we have to continue on into the work of real peacemaking, of real lasting justice, such that all people can flourish in the region. And for our world, we're really asking right now, as a global body, do we believe that might is right, or that our futures cannot be separated from each other? That we can only flourish alongside of each other. And it's a question that we're seeing play out, as you all have said, in Ukraine, in Russia, in China, in other places in the Middle East, like Syria, right? This question of what kind of world do you want to live in? And are we going to invest in a future where all of us can flourish? It's an important question. And it's one that all of us have to ask and be willing to stick our necks out for, right? Especially as you're saying, Greg, those of us who come from perhaps Christian backgrounds like myself and my community, there's an opportunity here to provide a vision and to stand for peace when our leaders, our community members, our families and our friends may not be doing so in the way that we would want. And it's not a partisan invitation. It's also not an exclusively Christian one. It's one for all of us, is what you were saying, Gary. We have so much agency and power in this moment to declare the possibility of something more for our world.
DeKalb, and I want to put a pin on that. It's more than an opportunity. It's a necessity to speak up and cast this different vision right now. We hear that talking about mutual flourishing is naive and silly and feel good. Wait a second. You want to talk about October 7th? October 7th showed us that these ideas of being safe and secure in our homes are a total illusion if our neighbors don't have any opportunity for any quality of life. This is delusional. Might carries a lot of power in the world. There is hard power. We're not saying that we just suddenly open every border and sit down and go oh, kumbaya, let's love each other. But at the same time, creating societies and warehousing whole people in situations in which there is absolutely no freedom or security or justice for generations. This never ends well. We're at a point in world history where this is an imperative. It's an imperative to speak out, say, no, it doesn't need to be this way. Yes, my safety is dependent upon my neighbor's well-being and vice versa. And that is truth. That's truth from a security perspective. It's truth from an economic perspective. And guess what? If you look at all the stated objectives of this war, what many people are calling a genocide in Gaza, sadly, I think this is, just the beginning for the region. But if you look at none of these objectives are actually achievable. So I just want to put a pin in this. I know what I'm saying is controversial, David, but it's the truth. The truth is that what we're seeing now makes us less safe. What we're talking about building a world in which there are agreed upon norms that we fight for together, that's our only way out of this. This other model, it's been proven time and time again to make everybody less safe. It makes a few people very wealthy. It makes some people very powerful. But this is anti-human. And for Christians right now, this is the prayer for this Easter time, for this Holy Week. Friday now, but Sunday's coming. The possibility of Sunday has to be there, but it's only going to happen if we speak up.
One way you can engage and speak up with us this week is by tuning in to our social media channels. We will be posting with a coalition of 7+ other organizations to promote daily devotionals and liturgies of the Mint around this season and this moment of Holy Week and Lent leading up to Easter, particularly in connection and in community with our Palestinian brothers and sisters. So stay tuned for those, share them in your communities and your networks, and join us for a live event this Saturday, Holy Saturday, at 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 p.m. Pacific, for the opportunity to hear from Reverend Dr. Muntha Isak from Bethlehem as a way to engage all of us right now, to point our eyes not only to resurrection and Easter, but also to the realities facing our friends and our brothers and sisters and our global neighbors in Gaza and across the region. So you can find more information about that in our show notes. Please join and invite your community. And there's going to be a very clear call to action as well on that call of how you can stay engaged in this moment for comprehensive and just peace for all people in the region. As always, you can rate and review our podcast on Apple Podcasts and on Spotify. Please share, engage the principles and practices of peacemaking, and point forward towards peace.